comic. What is on TV?
Because I stopped caring a couple months ago.
Everyone, this is John Allen Turner, and if you want to play some basketball today,
that's right. Yeah. Take it on, man. Sean thinks white people can't jump, but he doesn't know.
And that's because I played basketball with John. How many of you here have listened to our podcast, Not So Black and White, with? Okay, so that's basically what it is for 45 minutes.
That's right.
And then we'll talk about something important for
at some point in time, I'll bring up the fact that I'm secretly Latino.
Yes.
And then I'll ask Sean how he spells his middle name. and then I'll make some joke about how he's black, yes. And so he sees me a certain way, and he thinks, yeah. You know, whatever, and then he'll remind me that I'm Hispanic.
Yeah, and I was a terrible friend to John because I was going to use his computer and right. Was offered another, and I did not text him to let him know that he did not need to come.
And I left my daughter,
13-year-old daughter, alone in a strange place.
She's terrified now.
So.
She's terrified enough of Sean because he's black, you know. So,
our daughters are. We have two. We both have 13-year-old daughters who are addicted to their
technology.
So if you.
Hello.
Yeah.
So,
and anyway. I got Sean in trouble because I brought my 13-year-old with me, and now Sean has to bring his next year.
Yeah.
So,
but man, everyone, thanks John for getting up and getting and bringing the computer. Well, we're going to spend some time this morning talking about church, because I know that's a terribly important topic to a lot of people. But before we want to do that, though. I wanted to spend a little bit of time just having some church. So I invited three of my favorite worship leaders are in the room at the moment. But I'm going to have two of them who have a new venture I'm going to let them talk about just to lead us in some songs this morning. And I think it would be a good way on the second morning of Pepperdine Bible Lectures to get your blood going so you don't completely fall asleep before our time ends at 9:15. So I'm going to hand things over to Josh.
Let's sing together.
The splendor of the King and clothed in majesty, let all the earth rejoice, all the earth rejoice. He wraps himself in light, and darkness shines too high. It trembles at his voice, trembles at his voice. How great is our God! Sing with me, how great is our God! And all see how great, how great is our God! And age to age he stands in his hand, and time is in his hands, beginning and the end, beginning and the end. The Godhead three in one, and Father, Spirit, Son, the Lion and the Lamb, the Lion and the Lamb. How great is our God! Sing with me, how great is our God! And oh, see how great is our God!
And how great
name the heaven of
names! Sing with me,
you are worthy ever of sing, how hard to see, how great is our God.
My soul, my Savior, God to thee, and how great thou art, how great thou art. Sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee.
how great is our God.
Yeah, sing with me,
how great is our God.
And I'll
see how great, how great is our God. How great is our God. Sing with me, how great is our God.
And
I'll see how great, how great is our God.
Did the church say?
Amen.
Well, it's good to be with you guys this morning. We have been on a journey the last, actually a couple of years, but recently over the last 5 or 6 months, God has really called us to a ministry that I don't think we were all really aware of, but became cognizant over time where we knew we needed to do something in our tribe, Acapella tribe, to bring out a message that is really very powerful today. It's a message of reconciliation and unity. And so we put this ministry together called United Voice Worship. And the purpose of it is to bring people together. I don't know what everyone's relationship is in your towns or in your cities, but in my city of Houston, there are several predominantly black congregations. There's Latino congregations. There's white congregations. And there's a few that are striving to be more multi-ethnical and together as a church. And so we want to bring that opportunity to the table, and we want to actually encourage people, inspire people to come to the table about being more intentional about their communities and about their churches and what they're doing to celebrate differences. We want to put that spin on it where it's a very positive thing because, you know, we all know there's differences in our skin color or language barrier, but the one thing that brings us together is Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so that's the what forms this ministry, but it's an a cappella ministry that wants to provide and desires to provide music resources for churches and help people come together. So we're going to have this fall a conference. Nick, why don't you tell them about the conference?
Well, we got a United Voice conference. It's happening October 6th through 8th in Houston, Texas. It's at the Bammel Church, right off of 1960 in North Houston area. We got a few good people coming to share a few words from the Lord about what it means to be united. One of the things we've talked about a lot is endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Not that we're having to become united, but we are in fact united already through the blood of Jesus Christ. And that we are working, actively working, not passively waiting for someone else to do something about it. But we ourselves will take up the banner of unity. That we ourselves will become active participants in the mission of bringing reconciliation to the world. So Don McLaughlin is going to come and share some words to help remind us about his journey towards this through his own family and the work he's done in the city of Atlanta. Sean is going to be coming to help moderate and bring some thoughts as well. And there's a lot more people actually joining up as we speak. Some connections being made this week even. People who are going to come to present, to inspire, to encourage, to challenge us. Because I don't think we're without knowledge. We're without inspiration and without taking up the mantle. And that's what we're talking about. And we're doing that through worship, bringing people together. Because worship is a great time for us to remember we are just one body. Mm-hmm. We are just one people. We are all united in the same family through the blood of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And then we hold each other up. We hold each other accountable. We encourage each other. We inspire each other to live lives that are united. And that's what we're doing October 6th through 8th in Houston, Texas at the Bammel Church. You can find out more information on the website. UnitedVoiceWorship.org, not .com, .org. And it's going to be a great time there.
Dude, it's all right.
It's all right. Okay, well, let's do that. I love this song. This is a little bit of my home cooking, plus a little bit of some other stuff. So I hope the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Won't y'all sing with me? And I said, it's alright,
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 it's alright, because just a little talk with Jesus makes it right.
Do you believe it's alright,
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 it's alright, because just a little talk with Jesus makes it right. Was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in.
Standing there and worshiping with you all, and it almost happens every time, particularly with Nick, when Nick leads worship, and I'm like, I am transported back to my grandmother's church in Jackson, Mississippi. And maybe like you, I'm a child of the church and don't understand my life. It makes no sense outside of that context. And so I decided a couple years ago that I felt like the church was facing some challenges that we weren't really facing all that well. And we needed to look at what our next steps moving forward as not just a movement in restoration, but the church in America needs to do to move forward well. Because the truth is, and you know this is not a secret, there are probably 100 classes this week that are going to mention it, American churches are in trouble. If you look at certain metrics, if you look at attendance, if you look at reputation, I was having a conversation the other night with some people and they were talking about qualifications of elders. And one of those qualifications or one of those qualities that we always look at that we never talk about is their reputation outside the church in the community. Mm-hmm. And if the church had to be judged on the qualifications of an elder, we have a terrible reputation outside of the community. Ooh, all right, and so I thought we need to talk about what it looks like to be the actual church that Paul envisioned, that Jesus envisioned in the New Testament. So I decided I should probably write a book about that. Actually, I didn't decide that. My friend Jonathan Stormett decided that for me. And I was sitting in my office one day, and Jonathan called and said, you know, you really ought to write a book. And I didn't want to do that because I was probably tired that day. But the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to pursue that idea. And so for those of you who've ever written a book or been part of that process, you know there's a whole thing you have to go through of writing a proposal and sending that off to your agent. And if people knew what the actual publishing industry was like, you would be very circumspect of every book that you ever bought, especially a Christian book. And one of the evidences of that is that book was supposed to be released yesterday, called Unarmed Empire, and it's not. It won't come out until September, so if you want to get a hold of that book, which I really do, and I'm telling you this not because I need the money or going to make money off of it, you need to buy at least two copies. And that's because you need one for you, and you need one for anyone in your life that has been hurt, shunned, left outside looking in at the church, and you need to give that to them. And you might need to buy three copies to give to the people who hurt and shun those people.
Amen.
So if you will email me at Sean at the Palmer Perspective, and just either in the subject line or in the text, just say book, or you can go to my website, The Palmer Perspective, and subscribe. When the book comes out, you will be the first to know, and we're going to do some other things behind the scenes for folks who pre-order it or buy it the first week. So keep it. You can email me right now, and I will keep that list, and you will be on the list to get it when it comes out in September. Sean at thepalmerperspective.com. It's right over there. So, I am a child of the church. One of those kids who may be like some of you. I think my mom missed maybe one service between the time that I was born and the time that I showed up at church. We have people in our congregation right now who have a baby, and we won't see them for like 4 months. That wasn't my experience. And we were there every time the doors were open. So I admit, like, I am a conversion of nurture. I don't have a great conversion spirit of darkness to light. I was the kid in VBS who got all of the answers right, who won the trophy, the little Fishers of Men trophy, for bringing the most friends to VBS. I don't know that I was concerned about the gospel or their souls all that much. I just wanted the trophy. My mother still has that trophy. I won a lot of trophies as a kid for baseball and soccer, and I think that's the one that she's proudest of. The others are in a box in a garage with her saying to me repeatedly, "When are you going to come get these trophies?" And I said, "Well, probably, you know, when you're dead," which I hope is a long time, but I'm not interested in them. But I was, and always am, a child of the church. And so that gives me a certain love and appreciation. And we live in a time and a culture now where even people inside the church don't care about the church. So one of the things I learned in the process of writing this book is that when I talked to publishers and agents and all those people, what came back over and over and over and over again was this idea. No one's interested in a book about church. That largely inside the church, what we do is we go to our congregations, we pick our congregations and live inside of those congregations, basically for religious goods and services that benefit us. Mm-hmm. And when they cease to benefit us and we're called to something outside of ourselves, then we tend to abandon that church or abandon being part of that church. And so how many of you have been to a church where the preaching, which I think is a good thing, is primarily about felt needs. The programs are about felt needs. And if you can't manage a way to make people feel like they are in dire threat and need to do something, have a problem that your church can solve, they're probably not going to be interested. But what if there's this community in the world that exists not to be a drain on everyone else, but a people who are released to bring healing and reconciliation to the world, what Martin Luther King called a beloved community. And so I started thinking more and more about that and down the rabbit hole. And I discovered what many folks think about the church. Angelo Biafra, who is the lead singer for the Dead Kennedys, says, "If you love God, burn a church." And I don't think you're going to have a hard time imagining why someone might say something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you may have heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. They made women's garments And this was in the 1910s and 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory caught on fire. There were scraps of paper that were left all over the floor. It was before the time where there was large regulations. People walked around all the time smoking and dropping their cigarette butts. Whenever you hear someone talk about there's too much regulation in business and all that, that might be true. I'm not sure I don't work in that world, but when there's not regulations in business, this is the kind of thing that happens. Right. You walk into a business today, you'll see a sign that say, these doors to remain unlocked during business hours. There were no signs like that at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Most of the doors were locked. It was theft prevention to keep girls who were 12, 13, 14 years old from stealing material. So most of the doors were locked. They were only unlocked during the entrance and exits as shifts would change. And so the building caught on fire during a shift change, and the fire raged through the entire building. Some of the girls who worked at the factory made it to the ceiling, made it to the roof, and they were saved by some professors at the New York University Law School that was next door, and they just loaded ladders to bridge some of the girls over. About 16 girls escaped, but over 144 people died in that fire. And when people like Jello Biafra look at the church, they say, that would be a good outcome for the church. Just burn the whole thing up. But at least, you know, he cares. When I was working here in California, we lived in the San Francisco area. There was a girl at our congregation named Nicole. She was 18 years old, had been at that church her entire life, and was headed off to college. Absolutely beautiful, smart girl. She's in the Miss USA system for pageants. And she told me her senior year of high school, she says, when I graduate, I'm never going back to church again. And she said it so plainly and matter-of-factly that I wish that she cared enough that she'd at least want the church to burn, like she had some level of passion about it. And I asked her why that was, and she says, well, because I'm a Democrat and the church hates Democrats. Mm-hmm. And this is a girl who's been very active in social justice work, very caring for her community, but the message that she got, not outside of the church, but in the church, is that if you were different from us, or the majority of us, or at least the message that was coming down from on high at that local church, then you were not welcomed here. And that was made plain one Sunday morning when another one of our members, a college student who was at Stanford at the time, brought a friend of hers to class, to church, rather. And one of our elders at the time got up, and we were talking about marriage, we were in a series about marriage, and made the great joke, God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Which, first of all, isn't even funny. And I learned from Bob Goff yesterday that nothing's true if it rhymes. And I watched her friend get up and walk out. So I called him the next day and turned out that he identifies as homosexual. He grew up in the church, at his home church. He used to have forums. There was an open place. His home church didn't agree with him, but they welcomed him and allowed him to have a place for conversation and a place where he could bring his friends and they would feel welcomed. And they learned through that system that they did not have to be affirming to help people feel affirmed. And I wish that I could tell him, I wish I could tell Nicole the same thing I told him, which is there are a lot of other churches, this is San Francisco, after all, there are a lot of churches where you can be welcome just as you are, but she was so done. My chauffeur and best friend in high school was a guy named Wes. Wes is a fabulous musician. We both played trombone. He was first chair. I was second chair and a distant second chair at that. We were in the Stone Mountain High School Jazz Ensemble, which is the number one high school jazz band in the nation for 14 years. We toured Europe in the summers. He's a fabulously gifted musician. He is now a member of the Grammy vote. When you watch the Grammys, he's voted on those. If we lived in a world where people still bought CDs, you would open up a CD and you would see liner notes and you would probably see his name a lot as a composer and arranger. Wes grew up Methodist. His parents are still a part of the same Methodist church that they have been a part of now, I think, maybe for 40 years. And I used to love going there because they let me play in their band on Christmas and Easter. And $40 is a lot of money for a high school kid with very little other discernible skills. And so when Wes was young and just getting started in the music industry, he toured with a Christian band. Now, one of the things you might not know about Christian bands is that a lot of people in Christian bands aren't actually Christians. Right. And I'm not saying that they're not good Christians. I'm saying they are not actually Christians. But a lot of them are very hardcore Christians. Like, it's just like it's a market. And this is one of the things I think we ought to be aware of. Like, you go in the store and you like this Christian band, like, you actually don't know if they're Christians. And a lot of the music that we listen to are written by people in Nashville who are really good at writing songs, and they aren't Christians either. It's just the language has been decoded, and so they write it. And so one night, as they're sitting around, I'm talking about everything going on in the world. The lead singer of this band, and Wes is just there as a hired gun, looks around the table and says, "You know, I just think those fags are just destroying this country." And people like Nicole and Wes look at the church and they say, "Oh, I'm not going to be a part of something like that." And this is where we are losing so much both respect and so much possibility. Because we have oriented ourselves to the world in a way that is not just off-putting, but antithetical to the gospel of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So it's not that you're as bad at being church right now. It's that we are not actually being church right now. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, we are caught in this information loop where we're talking to each other and we're quite honestly looking at and listening to people in the Christian subculture who are not interested in the mission of the church. So, the people that you watch on cable news, listen to on the radio, who have opinions about how everybody should live, do not have the same agenda that we have about living in the world.
Right.
They do not have a kingdom agenda. And so, it's easy to have strong opinions about everything if you don't have to get anything done for the Lord. Right? And so, it's very easy to have a way that you think everybody ought to act, whether you act that way or not, because it keeps ears tuned and eyes tuned to what you're saying, but it's not actually being the hands and feet of Jesus into the world. It's not actually creating a community of welcome and hospitality for people. And so what the church is actually supposed to do in this world that we have been given is to be a community of welcome and hospitality. And we don't do that very much or very well, not even for one another. Here's, I think, the diagnosis, or at least this is the diagnosis that I propose in the book. The situation we've arrived in as a Christian church, particularly in America, has erupted from one central and misguided longing, the desire to possess and control an empire. To have a place where things are done not necessarily God's way, but our way. So to do that, you have to do some things along the way. You have to suppress dissent and discussion. You have to marginalize certain people who will not yield to your view of the world. You have to elevate certain people to positions of privilege and prominence. And you have to do all of those things, not so that the name of the Lord will be declared, but so that the culture reflects and exists the way that we want it to.
Come on now.
And we're not always wrong about that. We're not always wrong about how culture should function. We're not always wrong about how people should go about life, what produces human flourishing. We're increasingly wrong about how we go about doing it. And so one of the things that we have decided not to do, because we are fundamentally cognitive misers. And a cognitive miser means this, that when you walk into a room, you immediately start to search for that in that room for people who are the most like you. You do it without thinking, You do it not trying to do it. And the reason you do it that way, the reason we all do it that way, is because our brains want to be really helpful to us. Life is hard. You've got parents, you've got children, you've got work, you've got bills, you've got hard stuff to do every day. And so your brain says, I'm going to make some things easy for you. And getting to know people who are not like you is really hard. It requires time, it requires listening and attention. And so I'm going to take that off your plate. And you spend time with people who are like you because that's easier. So whether it's race, class, gender, when you walk into a room, you immediately scan to see who is most like me because that's going to be the easiest relationship. So hardly anyone is talking about the hot button issue of the 1960s, which was school desegregation. And you know why they're not talking about it? It's not because schools are not segregated anymore. It's because we don't care anymore. Right. And it's not because desegregation didn't work. It actually did. All the people who were worried about lowering test scores for good schools, none of that happened. What happened was we found it was really hard. And we said, oh, this is just too hard. We don't want to do this anymore. So let's do something else. And so our brains say, I don't want to do hard stuff when I don't have to do hard stuff. Because there is no reward in this country for getting to know and love people who are unlike you. Unless you are a Christian. And so instead of loving people, as Henry Nouwen says, like we just trade loving people for power. And so my act of love becomes, how do I get more of you to be like me? Because I find it really easy to love me. I've never had a trouble. I've had trouble liking me. And I know more about me than you know about me. So I know all the stupid stuff that I've done. And I was like, that was really dumb. Like, I know all of that. But I don't have trouble loving me. I want the best for me. And so if I want the best for me, the way I have told myself to give the best to you is for you to become like me. And so when you become like me, then we can all get together and the best will be everyone becoming like me. So I always think about this in terms of end zone dances. Do you know who has the most trouble and complains most about end zone dances? White people. White people act like you've been there before. Why? Because you can't dance. You're just mad. But it's this idea, do things the way that I would do them. Right? And so if you extrapolate that from person to small group to church to American church, our main priority has been in my lifetime to make other people like us. And to do that, to make other people like us, requires power and the exertion of power. So Henry Nouwen put it this way. He says, every time we see a major crisis in the history of the church, such as the Great Schism of the 10th century, the Reformation of the 16th century, or the immense secularization of the 20th century, we always see that a major cause of rupture is the power exercised by those who claim to be followers of the poor and powerless Jesus. And what I want to argue is that the Christian mission in the world is to forsake power for the sake of community. That our way forward is community. And I just want you to imagine. And I love worshiping with these guys. And I think most people know my church is instrumental. And so I do, you know, like the a cappella reunion conference, concert last night, like I'm 13 years old again, right? But what if in all of our talk about a cappella music, what if our central argument had been harmony? What if that was an illustration of what we were actually trying to do? Those of you who are old enough remember the 90s? Remember the worship wars? Which weren't really about worship, they were about singing. What would that have been like if we said, you know what? The church exists for community, not power. So if that's what you want, I'm fine with that. How many extra churches do we have? Which preachers like, because there's more pool for jobs. How many extra churches do we have now because of worship wars? Because we believe in power, not community. And you all know this. We have all these skills because all of us have people in our family, and we yield power for the sake of the community. I have two daughters. We have never been on a vacation I wanted to go on. Like Louis C.K. says, you know, when you get ready to go on a road trip, he says, I close the door to the trunk of the car and walk from the trunk around to the driver's door. That's my vacation. Because we yield power for community, for people who we love. But churches are resistant to doing that. And we're talking about why tomorrow. But I want you to imagine, because we don't talk about this nearly enough, just the corrosive effects of power. And there are some very good uses of power. And if you've got power, you should read Andy Crouch's book, Weak and Strong. Is that what it is, Jonathan? Because there are some ways, if you have power, to not exercise that power are actually sinful. Like if you've got power to bring healing, if you've got power to bring justice, if you've got power to do certain things, and you don't do it, that's an injustice. But power's always been corrosive, and we see it every day in the headlines. But churches largely exist for power, and we support people who tell us they will give us more power because we really hate the idea of suffering. So Paul's facing this in the church in Rome, and he writes this to them. He says, if people mistreat or malign you, bless them. Always speak blessing, not curses. If some have cause to celebrate, join in the celebration. If others are weeping, join in that as well. Work toward unity and live in harmony with one another. Avoid thinking you are better than others or wiser than the rest. Instead, embrace common people and ordinary tasks. Embrace common people and ordinary tasks. There's just nothing power-laden about that. Do not retaliate with evil, regardless of the evil brought against you. Try to do what is good and right and honorable as agreed upon by all people. If it is within your power, make peace. So when you have power, what do you do with that power? You make peace. Now, Paul says this in the backdrop of a Roman world who had a way of making peace through power, which was, we'll just drop 59. I mean, we'll just come in and conquer you, and that will bring peace. And it's basically the same thing. If you do what we say, you'll have peace. But that's not actually the way peace works. And I think for a long time, the church has played along with this power narrative that things would just be better if everybody did what we said, because that's easier than building community. Like, it's just easier. As hard as it seems, it's easier to get Supreme Court decisions than to make community. As hard as it seems, it's easier to get certain people elected from mayor to the local sheriff to congresspeople than to make peace. Because we all instinctively know at a root level that to make peace means that we'll have to sacrifice something. And I would rather sacrifice this check for my candidate or this check for this cause than to sacrifice something that's really vital and valuable to me and that gives me a sense of identity. And I'm one of those people who really upholds the identity of Christianity. And we live in a time now where people are kind of selling bits and pieces of Christianity off to the other religious highest bidder. Like, I'm going to take some Buddhism here and some Baha'i here, and I'm going to take some Judaism over here, and it's all going to be the same. But I do think there's something unique and special and divine about Christianity. So in 2012, Pew Research Center reported that 1 out of 5 Americans, about 46 American adults, self-reported no affiliation with church. And in those moments, I think it's very easy for Christian leaders to just go to the grab bag of excuses. Like, no one is interested in faith, or it's the gay agenda, it's working moms, it's Democrats, it's the media, it's fundamentalists. If you want to know what all the excuses are, on the right and on the left, just go to the blogs. Mm-hmm. And all of that obscures the truth, which is this, that the church is partly responsible if people want to burn the church. We failed to be the church, and folks don't need highly sensitive failure detectors in order to notice. But at the same time, like, I grew up in this beautiful, creative, meaningful body that gave structure and meaning to my life. Like, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I fell in love with the church before I fell in love with Jesus. And I'm not the kind of guy that just goes around falling in love with stuff. So if that could happen for me, that could certainly happen for other people. And so at the heart of the book, which I hope you buy 3 of, is looking at the letters of Paul and what Paul is constructing and the nature of the way he talks about the church. I want to talk about that a little bit tomorrow, a great deal tomorrow, and how we get along in a world where we are really divided. And I want to talk about the Wednesday night after the Tuesday of the last election and what that was like in our church community. I don't know if it was like that in your community, and how you bridge those gaps and how the church can move forward. But I wanted to share with you, because I am who I am, one of my favorite poets, which is Naomi Shihab Nye. And if you hate poetry, don't ever come to my house at bedtime. Because at bedtime, many nights, you don't only do prayers. You have to do the poem. Which, when you have a 13-year-old daughter who is just cooler than everything in the world, is a pain in the butt. And her eyes, I think, might literally roll out of her head at one point. But this is Naomi Shihab Nye writing about Gate A4. She says, "Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal after learning my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate A4 understands Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumbled to the floor, wailing. 'Help!' said the flight attendant. 'Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this.' I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. 'Shudao a, shubidik, habiti, stanchi squa, min flalik, shubit, shawi.' The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for a major medical treatment the next day. I said, 'No, we're fine. We'll get there just later. Who is picking you up? Let's call.' We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him, then we called her other sons, just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling her friends, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar, smiling, there is no better cookie. Then the airline broke out free apple juice and huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it, and they were covered in powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend. Out by now, we were holding hands. She had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medical thing with green furry leaves, such as an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary travelers, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those older women too. This can still happen anywhere, she says. Not everything is lost. So I can be pretty dire about where the American church is. But what she captures in Gate A4, that's the world I want to live in. And I just have to believe that once we get over all of the confusion brought on by difference, that this world is still possible. So we're going to talk about that world tomorrow. I hope you come back. Thanks for coming. Appreciate it.